right, thank you for joining me on The Gospel Truth. I'm your host, Marlon Wilson, and today we have a great show today. Let me cut my volume down a little bit. Today we have a great show today, and we are interviewing, he sort of hit the scene with a big old splash, man. He's had many conversations on capturing Christianity. He's all over the place on his YouTube channel and conversing with different Christians, and I think he even conversed with a Muslim, I believe he has, and he's pretty popular on YouTube. And this conversation that we're gonna have is definitely not one that is friendly fire, if you will. Not necessarily that we're going to go and antagonize each other, but he definitely is opposite of my worldview. I'm a Christian, as everybody know, and he is what he would describe as a naturalistic pantheist. And or an atheist, or I'll let him explain his worldview. I'm not gonna go too much into worldview. I'll let him do that. I'll misrepresent him. But before we go into this conversation, I do want to ask you, if you could, to go ahead and like and subscribe and follow my Facebook page, The Gospel Truth, and also my YouTube page, The Gospel Truth. Also, I'm on Twitter as well. If you can go ahead and follow me there, and make sure when you subscribe and follow on Facebook and YouTube, to go ahead and cut your notification bells on, that you will be notified when I upload new content and when I go live. Also, as you know, we've been having a book giveaway this month. And this month, we are giving away Voody Bakum's Family Shepherd. And yesterday, the book giveaway expired. And we have two winners. I have a winner by the name of Eric Minifield and Odick Meboden. And they both have won free books. I will send this book, The Family Shepherd by Voody Bakum, to them. Once you guys see this, I'll be messaging you in your inbox to let you know that you won and get your address, and the book will be on its way to you. Thank you once again for, you know, doing what you had to do to win this book. With that said, also, at the beginning of July, I'll announce the new book giveaway. So keep your ears and ears open for that one. So I also want to announce my upcoming shows as well. I'll be having June 26th, I'll be having Joshua Arnold on, and he'll be conversing with me concerning his deliverance from drug addiction and his formal life as part of the New Age movement. So we'll be having that discussion. Also, I'll be having Adam Coleman on July 6th, and we'll be discussing urban apologetics. So that should be a lively discussion, real good discussion as well. And also, July 15th, I'll be having David Shannon on. And David Shannon is very popular. He's on the Cross Politics. And Cross Politics is a show that airs on YouTube and on Facebook Live as well. And he'll be coming on. We'll be discussing the issues of abortion and how it affects our culture and our political scene as well. With that said, I am about to go ahead and introduce Mr. Tom Jump. Like I said, Tom Jump is very popular on YouTube, and he has discussions of Catholic Christianity YouTube channel and everything, and he's an atheistic philosopher. So I want to get his spill on that and how that came together. And also, he's an aspiring president of the United States as well. And that is interesting. That is interesting. So we're going to talk about that a little bit as well. And he just simply likes to debate stuff. So it should be a real good discussion. And so let me bring Tom on real quick. So I won't keep talking about it. I let him talk for himself.
Hear me?
Yeah, I hear you, Tom. How's it going, Tom? Thank you for coming on for me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for giving me the invite. I really appreciate the opportunity. Happy to be here. I'm an atheist, so not a naturalistic pantheist. Pantheism is like the spaghetti monster. It's an alternative I use to contradict theism to show that the arguments can work for lots of different things.
Gotcha.
So I'm an atheist, which means I believe there are no reasons or evidence to indicate the existence of a God.
Okay.
And I try to demonstrate this by saying any evidence that you can come up with, I can show it works for all these different alternatives like naturalistic pantheism or deism or polytheism, transtheism, henotheism, these kinds of alternatives to theism people don't normally think of. And so imagine you have a box. And if you claim that there is a rabbit in this box, and you claim that the reason there's a rabbit in this box is because the box weighs 2 pounds. Well, the 2 pounds isn't actually evidence of a rabbit, because it could also be explained by a lizard or a coffee mug or Legos or a 2 pound weight, or lots of different alternatives. So if I can show that whatever evidence you present for a God is kind of like that 2 pounds, and can be explained by all these different alternatives, then it's not really evidence of a God, just like the 2 pounds isn't really evidence of a rabbit. And I think all of the different evidence and arguments that theists present are kind of like that 2 pounds. It works for anything that has these omni properties, the all-powerful, all-knowing, all-loving, eternal. If you add this to a theory, well, then anything works. Anything works to explain all the theistic arguments. So, but science doesn't do that. Science doesn't use these properties because they aren't demonstrable. You can't empirically demonstrate them at all. But if they did, you could add the all-powerful to the multiverse or whatever, and then the multiverse would be able to explain the origin of everything just like God does. And so everything that the theists do when they put in these omni properties to explain a God, well, that works for just anything. You could add those to any theory you want and just explain everything about the universe. And so none of it's really evidence for the existence of God. It's more just, here's something we can't explain and we're going to make up an explanation for it. That's my position.
Interesting. You said omni properties. Go ahead and define omni properties for those who don't know.
So omni properties would be like omnipotence, omnibenevolence, omniscient, and those are statements like all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-good. So it has infinitely much power. Everything there is to know is the epitome of absolute goodness. The absolute encompassing properties that entail there is nothing greater or beyond that thing.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that spiel. I first have to point out the chair that you're in is becoming a real popular thing on your shows, man. It's the comforter. I don't know if it's a comforter or it kicks your legs back or whatever it is, man. But it looks super comfortable, man.
Yeah, it's a Lazy Boy Crandell recliner. A couple people have asked that, like, what kind of chair is that? It's a Lazy Boy Crandell recliner.
Okay. Cool. All right. So, you said that you're an atheist. So would you say that you're an atheist in regard to there's no possibility that there is a God, or you don't believe in a God, or you just don't know there is a God?
Well, it depends on the kind of God. So I would say that there isn't a Christian God. There can't be the Christian God because there's contradictions in the properties. Like an all-powerful, all-good God would not allow suffering, and there is suffering. So the fact that there is suffering means there can't be an all-good, all-powerful God. So I definitely believe there is not the existence of the Christian God. It does not exist. But there could be other kinds of a God, maybe like a deistic kind of a God who is impartial and doesn't really care about us, or kind of like the Greek gods or the Roman gods. Those are possible, and I can't disprove those, but I don't have any reason to believe they exist. So I'd be more agnostic on those kinds of things. Like, I'm agnostic on the proposition that there's like some kind of a being on Alpha Centauri, so in Centauri, in the different universes or whatever. I don't really know, but I don't have any reason to believe that they exist at this time.
Okay. So you mentioned suffering, right? And obviously, that's one of the primary arguments from the atheistic worldview. They tend to argue that suffering is a big issue. And so from your worldview, from the atheistic worldview, how is it that suffering is a problem?
Well, suffering is a contradiction in the properties of a God. So if there is a God, and God is all good, so he wants the best for us, then he wouldn't create a world that causes us suffering, because that's not the best for us. So suffering is only a problem in the Christian worldview, where there is this being who would want to create a world that is the best for us.
I mean,
he clearly didn't.
Sure, but what...
In the atheist worldview, mm-hmm. it's not a problem because there's nothing there that wants the best world for us. It's just kind of random. It doesn't care. So if the universe doesn't care about us, there's no reason for there not to be suffering, because it doesn't care. So why would it make a world without suffering?
Well, what if God did not create the world originally in suffering? What if God did not create the world in that nature?
Well, if God allowed any suffering at any point that was not voluntary, that's still immoral, and that's still not the best world for us. So even if he didn't originally create it and it came later, that's still immoral. That's still not the best for us.
So when individuals make the decision to sin or to do something that is contrary to God's original design, that's God's fault?
Yes, because God designed the world in such a way that if you contradict God's plan, then you suffer for it. So it's kind of like a trap. If you put a mouse trap in the middle of the floor and the mouse goes to eat the cheese and the mouse gets smashed by the mouse trap, the person who killed the mouse was the person who made the trap. It's not the mouse's fault. The mouse just wanted the cheese. And that's kind of like us. When we go to do things against God's plan, God created this mouse trap of suffering that he forced on us against our choice. We didn't choose the suffering. God chose the suffering. And so we're like the mouse being trapped in the mouse trap. The person who's at fault is the person who built the mouse trap, not the mouse.
So you're saying God chose the suffering. Is that God chose the suffering? What do you mean by God chose the suffering? Because the biblical text teaches that God did not choose the suffering. It was those who sinned against God that God had to put down punishments for their sin. So is there a problem with God having to have the authority to hand out punishment for his creation?
Well, the choice was that he chose to make a world with suffering. He could have chosen to make a world without suffering.
But that's what I keep saying, is that God did not choose to make the world with suffering. His original design was good. And there was no suffering until Adam and Eve bit the fruit, ate the fruit, and they sinned. That entered those kind of things. Sinful nature. Because a lot of suffering that we see is due to sin.
Right, but he created the tree. He created the apple. He created the garden. So he put all of that in place before Adam and Eve were there. So he made all of that, including the world that would lead to suffering, before Adam and Eve got there. He made the mousetrap. The mousetrap already existed. The cheese was there. The snappy thing was there, all before Adam and Eve. So that, again, he designed the mousetrap. He put the cheese with the apple next to the tree of knowledge. And the tree of knowledge is the mousetrap that smashes the mouse and causes the suffering. So God designed the mousetrap. The person at fault here is the mousetrap maker, not the mouse.
So, I really want to emphasize to you that when it comes to God's decree, when it comes to God decreeing things into existence, decreeing things to happen, it's because of his plan. He has a plan that's preordained before the foundations of this world in order to ensure that his historical plans happens. So in that, there is an aspect of God having control over things, being able to control aspects, being able to allow things to happen according to his overarching plan. And in that also, we can't eliminate the foundational function that human beings, they do have free will. And in that free will, they do make decisions according to their bondage, according to what their desires are. So in a sense, when Adam and Eve ate the fruit, they ate the fruit with the understanding that they had the free will ability to do so. This is something, because the way you're arguing, you're arguing in a sense that you're saying that almost like God made them do it in a sense. And I don't think that's the case. God did not make them do it in a sense.
So I'm arguing that God could have created a world where all suffering was voluntary. So essentially, he could have created a world where any suffering was optional. So if you didn't want to feel the pain or feel heat, like it's really hot outside, you could just turn the dial down and turn the heat off. Like every person, every individual gets their own universe. You can do whatever you want with it. And it's physically impossible for anyone to force anyone else to do anything they don't want to. He could have created this world. So all suffering, anytime you would have experienced suffering, would be totally optional. You could just turn the suffering off. Turn the heat down if it's too hot. If someone throws a coffee mug at you or something, you can just have it pass through you like you're a ghost and it wouldn't hit you, wouldn't hurt you or anything. You can just turn off all suffering and make it just voluntary. If there was an all good God, that's the world he would have created.
But an all good God, according to your standard, though. So according to your standard, what makes your standard the objective standard beyond anybody else's standard?
Because it's intuitively obvious that any time of forcing people to do things against their consent is immoral.
But once again, like, you're using that word force, and once again, I explained to you that God is not forcing anybody to do anything. They're making decisions according to their desires. So if they're making decisions according to their desires, how is God forcing anybody? Go ahead.
Like, I'm forced to experience heat right now. I don't have the choice to turn the heat off. I don't have that option. God forced me to be in this world with this suffering, with this pain, with the heat, the death, cancer, disease, all of these things. These aren't optional. I don't get to choose these. I was forced to live in this world. This isn't something I wanted. And I was forced to do this by God. It's not like I volunteered to be here. So does that make sense, where God is forcing me to be in this world full of suffering? I didn't get the option to go to a different world without suffering.
But you're jumping from, but when you say suffering and things like that, God is forcing things upon people, you're making a moral judgment. You're making a moral case saying that God is immoral. You're essentially attempting to make God out to be a moral monster. And that's what I'm saying, is that if you're making judgments on suffering, I'm asking you, how is your world view the standard? How's your worldview the objective standard to morals? I guess I'm trying to understand how, from your perspective, from your position, your worldview, how can you make any moral judgments and make them objective to the point where you're injecting that into, say, the Christian worldview?
Oh, right. So most philosophers are atheists. And most philosophers believe in objective morality. So you don't actually need a God to believe in objective morality. Atheistic objective morality is pretty common. And I'm one of them. I believe in objective morality. So my basis of objective morality is the description of the best of all possible worlds for all possible wills. And so if we're moving closer to that world, that's good. And move further away, that's bad. So my objective standard is a world where it is impossible for any being or to be forced involuntarily to do something they don't consent to. That's the description of the best of all possible worlds.
Yeah, but because most philosophers, according to you, most philosophers are objective moralists, that doesn't necessarily mean that their standard is a standard for all. So once again, my question is you're making moral statements, you're making moral judgments, and I'm trying to get the understanding that, okay, Tom Jump's morality might be his morality. And once again, I don't want to say, I don't want the picture to be shown that I don't think atheists or anybody can't have morals without God. I do believe that atheists and, you know, Muslims or Mormons can have morals without God, or anybody can have morals without God. But what I'm saying is that in the atheistic worldview, there's no way you can objectively make a standard, because now I would say that you're borrowing from the Christian worldview in order to make those type of standards, make those type of statements. Because in the atheistic worldview, there is no standard of that nature. There is no objective standard that God that lays down a law, if you will.
Right. That's why I brought up the philosophers. The experts in the field of ethics can ground objective morality in lots of different things. You don't need a God for that.
But where do they get those
assumptions?
Yeah, but where do they get the template, if you will, for those moral ethics?
There's lots of different places. Most people ground a basis in morality in moral intuition and moral progress.
Yeah, but the moral intuitions come from where?
Intuitions. They're intuitions.
Yeah, but are intuitions material?
They're a product of the brain.
Yeah, but are they material? That's the question. Are they immaterial?
No, they'd be a product of the brain. So they're a material thing, a material function, a chemical process in the brain.
Explain to me how intuitions are material.
They're physical processes in the brain due to chemical biochemical interactions.
In those biochemical reactions, you're making moral judgments in those biochemical reactions. Just to put it simply, if we put vinegar and baking soda together, does that create the logical capacity to I guess come to a moral decision?
No, because those don't have the ability to process information, but we do. So it's like a calculator is just made of electricity, like ones and zeros and silicone, but it can still do math objectively. It can still get to objective truth, even though it's just made of like fizzing stuff.
But there's just information in there, right? There's information in there that's causing that to be able to do so, right?
Information is everywhere. Everything, information is a product of matter. So all matter has information.
Sure.
It's just a part of nature.
Sure.
The fizzing vinegar stuff, that has information too.
Yeah, but I guess my point is, when it comes to the vinegar and the baking soda and the vinegar idea, is that that's essentially what's going on. I mean, according to your worldview, we're having chemical reactions in our brains, right? In those chemical reactions, how do we come to the understanding that we have to have logical consistency when it comes to morality, when it comes to logically thinking through processes, when it comes to these ideas, these several ideas that we deal with on a daily basis, with chemical reactions, just random chemical reactions going on in the brain, how do we come to these moral decisions and things like that? How's that
through
possible?
Evolution filters out the bad random mutations. So if we have some random fizzing that gets things wrong, it dies. And if we have some random fizzing that gets things right, it survives and multiplies. Our brains, the random fizzing, if it gets things right and learns truth and morality and things, then it survives longer.
But once again,
the closer
go ahead.
So how the fizzing gets to truth is through evolution. It filters out the things that get it wrong and it keeps the things that get it right alive.
So evolution being evolution as an undetermined process, in a sense that there is no one directing the process. There is no intelligent being directing the process. You're telling me that through an indirected process that moral capacities can come about. Is that what you're telling me?
Yes.
Through random chemical reactions.
Sure. I mean, everything we see around us is a result of random chemical processes.
Yeah,
stars,
but, yeah.
The atoms, the quarks, universes, everything we see is a product of random chemical processes.
But I guess my point...
All of physics.
But I guess my point is that when it comes to knowledge, when it comes to reality, when it comes to these ideas, we live in a reality that says that there are morals, there are moral objectives, there are moral things that we have in place in order to keep somebody from harming somebody, for us to say this ought not be or this should be, right? So in that landscape, in that reality, in according to the atheistic worldview, and when there's this random chemical reaction, how do you consummate that reality? How can you come to that standard of reality to where these things are objectively true? And once again, I also emphasize, how can you come to a moral conclusion on God or anything with just random chemical reactions going on?
Well, again, so random chemical reactions doesn't help your case at all. So random chemical reactions may give us the wrong information, but they could also give us the right information. The fact that they're random chemical processes doesn't tell us one way or the other. Could be right, could be wrong. So we need some independent criteria to establish, do the vinegar and the baking soda fizzing, does that give us the right information or does it give us the wrong information? Because it could be either way. So just saying it's fizzing baking soda and vinegar doesn't tell us anything. It could be right, it could be wrong. So the way we establish whether or not it's right and wrong is we use empirical verification for most of science. That's how we establish whether or not the things we experience about the world correspond to reality. And we can do the same thing with morals by doing moral thought experiments. That's what they do in philosophy. It's like the trolley problem, the fat guy trolley problem. There's one with a healthy guy who walks into a hospital problem. There's all kinds of problems that we can do to establish the moral legitimacy of our moral intuitions and moral progress. For example, the easiest one is that it is objectively moral to kill babies. That is objectively immoral. All atheists and theists usually agree to this. The Christian God killed babies. The Christian God is therefore immoral.
But once again, from what standard do you make those claims, Tom?
Well, again, there's tons and tons of objective standards here. It's really easy. Everyone in philosophy agrees here. This is not a tough issue. The question is which one is right? So my moral standard is the best of all possible worlds. My objective standard that applies to everything, including God, to describe what is moral and what is immoral, is the description of the best of all possible worlds for all possible wills. This is the objective standard.
Okay, but your standard is your standard. That's not, you can't impose your standard on me because you don't have the objective standard. So that's what I'm saying, is that you're telling me that killing babies is wrong. Okay, and you said, okay, and I agree, I agree, but the reason that I agree is from a totally different spectrum from where you agree, right? And you're saying that your moral objectivity is saying that babies are wrong, and I'm asking you, according to what standard is yours, is for you to say. I'm not talking about other philosophers, I'm talking about Tom Jump. According to Tom Jump's objective standard, what makes killing babies wrong? And where do you get that standard from?
Right. So the best of all possible worlds is equivalent to your God. It's the same. It's the same level. So if you think God is objective standard of morality, my best of all possible worlds is exactly the same level. Does that make sense? So
yeah.
My standard is equally authoritative as your God. Now, you don't have to accept it, just like I don't accept your God. But it's still an objective basis. Now, whether or not it's true or not is up for debate, just like it's whether or not a God exists is true or not is up for debate. That's something that we haven't solved in philosophy yet.
I mean, but in your possible world, would there be an objective lawgiver?
No, you don't need a lawgiver. Most laws don't come from lawgivers.
But that's my point, Tom, is that you're making objective claims, you're making moral claims, and you have no standard to go off of that. There's an objective standard that says this is absolutely wrong. So by you coming and saying like, babies are wrong, so the Christian God is absolutely foul, he's absolutely evil, you're making the objective claim, and I just don't think that in your worldview, in a worldview where there's random chemical reactions going on in your brain, and there's no way you can come to the conclusion that the God of the Bible is absolutely wrong, because once again, you're making an overarching moral claim. Does that make sense?
So again, the standard is the best of all possible worlds. It's like God. It's like saying, this is the standard. This is the lawgiver. The best of all possible worlds is the lawgiver.
But that best of possible world is, undetermined and just random then.
No, it's determined. It's like, what is your God? Like, does your God is determined by his nature, right? He can't lie. He can't do something against his nature, correct?
Sure, sure.
So then my best of all possible worlds is determined by its nature. Like the naturalistic pantheism is determined by its nature, just like your God is determined by its nature.
Okay. All right.
And so
go ahead. Finish it up.
And so just like your God has a basis of objective morality in his nature, my best of all possible worlds has an objective morality grounded in its nature. But you don't need a lawgiver to have that. Like gravity isn't from a judge or something. Gravity is a law of nature. It's just something that applies to everything by fiat. So morality can be the same kind of thing, like a law of nature, which doesn't come from a giver. It's just a thing that applies to everything that exists.
All right. So when it comes to the laws of logic, right? The laws of logic. How is it in your worldview that you can rationalize the laws of logic in the sense that do you believe that the laws of logic are consistent throughout the world?
The laws of logic is a formal language, but it's a human language like English. It's something that we use to describe reality. So reality exists, and reality is logic and math are language to describe reality. They're like tree. The word tree is consistent because it's how we define it. Logic and math are the same. They're consistent because they are definitions of how we perceive reality, but they don't force reality to be that way. Reality, 1 + 1 isn't true because of math. It's true because that's the way reality works, and we use math to describe reality. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. So, I understand. Like the laws of logic is a way to explain our reality or to realize our reality. I understand that aspect. But what I'm saying is that when it comes to the laws of logic, do you agree that it's an absolute standard to those laws of logic?
What do you mean?
Like the laws of logic, you explained to me that the laws of logic is just basically math, essentially language that we use. So do you believe that it's an absolute law language, if you will, that we all humans live by?
Well, it's how all of our brains understand reality, but there are definitely different kinds of logics. Like there's non-standard logics that reject the laws of thought, like the law of identity, law of non-contradiction, law of there are different kinds of logics that reject those, like the many-valued logic, intuitionistic logic, quantum logic. There's other kinds of logic, so it's not strictly universal. There are things that can describe reality. You don't need standard logic to do that, classical logic.
So it's
like a language. Like you can describe the word tree, but you can also describe it in Japanese. You don't need to use the English word tree. And logic is the same thing. We can use standard or classical logic to describe things, A equals A. We use the non-standard logics, like fuzzy logic and many-valued logic and intuitionistic logic. So I'm not sure what you mean by an objective standard there, because it's a language, the formal language I'm up with. There's an objective truth reality is, not just how we describe it.
Yeah, but the laws of logic is what we live in this reality, right? The reality of, you know, the earth or, you know, the world that we live in. But in this, we use the laws of logic on a daily basis. They're immaterial. They're abstract. So this is something that we use continuously. And so without the laws of logic, we wouldn't even be able to reconcile knowledge or anything like that. So I'm trying to see if that's the case, and if we have these laws of logic to help us rationalize our reality, help us rationalize the knowledge that we do have, how in your worldview do you reconcile that? Because in logic points to a transcendent being, because it's immaterial.
Most logicians don't agree with that at all. Most people in philosophy think that logic does not in any way point to anything transcendent or anything immaterial. Logic is, again, like English. It's just like a language, just like a human language. We both use English every day. Now, I don't speak a second language. I'm not sure if you do. But if we got rid of English, there are things to describe reality, like Japanese. We could just use, or Chinese, Mandarin, or Turkish, or Spanish, Mexican, all kinds of languages we can use. It's not required that we, and logic is the same way. You don't need logic, the standard logic, to describe reality. It's a different kinds of logics you can use. It's not objective in that sense, just like English isn't objective. It's just a tool we use.
Yeah, but the English, obviously the English language is a different language from a different, you can use a variety of language to explain the same thing, but laws of logic are consistent across the board. They're consistent across the board.
No, remember the laws of logic, like the law of non-contradiction, the law of excluded middle, the law of identity, those can be rejected. There are different logics that say, nope, these don't apply, these are false, and they have different laws. So they're not unisons. Like intuitionistic logic, many-valued logic, and quantum logic, each rejects one of those logics, one of those laws. So they're not objective in that sense. There's just different ways to describe things.
Yeah, there's different. I guess my point is that when we consider the laws of logic, and we consider how they are and what we need them for, the standard it definitely has to come from someone that is outside of that. Outside, it's an immaterial aspect concept. So it has to have something that comes out from that, a more intelligent mind that comes from that. And I'm just trying to reconcile that. How do you reconcile the fact that we use something that has such order as the laws of logic and the other logical aspects that you just mentioned when according to the atheistic worldview, it's just random chemicals randomly firing in the brain? How do you know anything? How do you have knowledge? How do you know the reality that you're in and things like that when we are randomly just have, or according to your worldview, when we're randomly just having random chemical reactions in the brains?
So again, the calculator is just random chemical reactions, but it still has knowledge. It still gives the answer.
But right. It has order to it, right? There's information in there.
Everything has information. The fizzing vinegar and baking soda has information. So everything has information. So fizzing and baking soda can't give you knowledge because it has information in it.
It has information, but it's not going to give us cognitive logic in the sense that way we think as human beings. It's not going to help us make rational moral decisions. I mean, these are very, very complex things, and it has no other choice but to come from a transcendent mind, a mind that's above our mind. It's too much order in that.
No, essentially everyone in academia disagrees with that completely. So no. So again, random fizzing could give you the wrong information, but it could also give you the right information. Like if I threw a bunch of Cheerios on the ground, it may just be a random mess, but it could also spell out a language, like a word or something.
So it's possible
that the random fizzing can have information in it. So the fact that we're random fizzing does not mean there is not information there. You can still get information. You can still get knowledge out of random fizzing. If we have a random fizzing of baking soda and vinegar, it could still spell out E equals MC squared. You can still get information out of random fizzing. So the fact that we're random fizzing does not mean there isn't information there. It does not mean we can't have knowledge. It just means we need a different criteria. Does that make sense? So the random fizzing can get you knowledge. Just like if we throw Cheerios on the ground, they can spell out a word. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but the probability of them throwing Cheerios out there spelling out a word is very, 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 very extremely right. The low probability, right?
Right. So you need some kind of a process to filter out the bad information and leave the good information, right? So if it's spelled like a bad word, you need to get rid of it. If it's spelled something close to a good word, you keep it and then use that one to move forward and get to a bigger word and a bigger word, right?
Yeah, but when it comes to evolution, it's an undirected process. There's no orchestra, if you will. There's nobody directing that. They're just randomly happening, right?
No, it's directed by living. So it's structured knowledge, and you gain more knowledge, you live longer. And if you live longer, you reproduce. And if you don't live longer, then you die off. And so the things that gain more knowledge live longer. And then they have kids who gain even more knowledge and live longer. And they have kids who gain even more knowledge and live longer. And so you get bigger and bigger words from those Cheerios.
I don't know if I buy that one, Tom. I don't know if I buy that one. I don't know, man. I don't know if I buy that one. One of your interviews, you said that the knowledge, I guess I'm trying to quote, I don't want to quote you wrong. I'm sort of paraphrasing a little bit. It says, knowledge entails certainty. Now, you have a certainty of knowledge that says that unicorns are not real and not actual, right? And you have a certain knowledge that says, I'm trying to remember what I wrote here. You said no to unicorns and no to ape ancestry or something like that. And it says that, and I wrote down, but God, there's absolutely certainty that the God of the Bible does not exist. Right? Does that make sense? I'm trying to recall what I wrote down. I had a note here.
So there's different kinds of knowledge. Like you can have fallible knowledge and infallible knowledge. Fallible knowledge is knowledge that could be right, but we just don't know it yet. Like maybe there are no unicorns. Like we can't be certain there are no unicorns. Maybe there's a unicorn in a different universe we just haven't discovered yet. Mm-hmm. Maybe Santa Claus exists somewhere in a different universe. We can't have infallible knowledge that there is no Santa Claus. But we can't have fallible knowledge. I mean, we could be wrong about it, but it's still knowledge. Yeah, but something like a god who claims that there's contradictory properties, like a round square. We can have pretty infallible knowledge that there can't be a round square because those are mutually exclusive things. They're contradictory. So if there's a contrary properties of a god, then we can have infallible knowledge that God doesn't exist. Just like we have infallible knowledge that a square circle doesn't exist.
Okay. So run up by me one more time. I missed the back end of what your statement. Go ahead, run up by me one more time.
All right, so we have fallible knowledge and infallible knowledge. Fallible knowledge is something that we can believe, but we can't be certain about. So like maybe unicorns probably don't exist. We can't be certain about it, but we believe unicorns don't exist. Infallible knowledge is things we can be absolutely certain about. There is no round squares. Okay. Round squares are a contradiction. They can't be the same thing. So if God has a contradiction in his property, then round square fallible knowledge exists.
Okay,
if he doesn't have any contradictions, like then he would be in, we can only claim infallible knowledge, like the unicorns.
And one of the contradictory properties of God is, according to you, is suffering.
Right.
But yet you make moral claims based off, but you're making moral claims, absolute moral claims, though.
Right, because I use a different objective standard.
What makes your objective standard the rule of thumb?
Because it's indicated by moral intuition and moral progress.
Moral intuition and moral progress. Okay, obviously I disagree with you on that one, but I just think that when, once again, and this is something that's going to continue to be reiterated over and over again, I just think that when we're talking about the worldview that proclaims evolutionary theory and things like that, and that proclaims the random processes of evolutionary process and things like that, I just don't see how we can come to the conclusion and make moral claims on something, on God, and think that's the okay standard. That's the okay standard. Because I do believe that you're borrowing from the Christian worldview in order to make these moral claims. I don't think that within your worldview, I don't think you have the fundamental aspect of the atheistic worldview. I don't think you have the foundation, if you will, or the pillars of that in order to justify your moral claims. And I think that's the big issue. And I think that's what I'm trying to drive home today, is that there is an inconsistency within the atheistic worldview whenever we start talking about morality, whenever we start talking about these ideas, because there is no moral objectivity there. There is no moral objective standard that says this is the moral objective. Now, we could point to different realities, the possible worlds and things like that. But the fact is that we live in this world. And in this world, there are a moral objectivity. There is a such thing as raping and killing children is absolutely wrong. So we could point to different realities. We could point to different worlds and all that. All that is just fantasy, in my opinion, because there is no evidence to suggest that there is a different world. There is a different reality. The fact is that we live in this reality. And the fact also is that in order to make moral claims in this world that baby killing babies is a form of suffering, you have to have an objective moral standard. And in order for your moral standard to hold weight in my worldview that says that might or might not say that, then how do you come to the conclusion injecting your worldview into mine? If you're saying that morality, your moral says that killing babies is wrong, 100% wrong, and because of that, God is evil, or the God of the Bible does not exist, how is your world, in this reality that we live in, how is your worldview able to come to that conclusion?
Right. So again, I do have an objective standard. Like I can say that objective morality is grounded in a law of nature like gravity. So it is a physical thing that exists in the universe like gravity, and it's objective like gravity is objective. So I can say naturalistic pantheism has a nature which grounds objective morality, just like you believe theism has a God has a nature which grounds objective morality. So they're exactly the same. They have the exact same foundations as each other. They're just saying there is this nature of this absolute omnipotent thing that grounds objective morality. So just like you have that, I also have that. Mine's just called naturalistic pantheism. It's just a part of the universe.
Yeah, but so, okay. So do you care? Do you care? Do you think it's wrong for me to just say that I had a light for killing babies? Obviously, I don't. But for the sake of conversation, let's say that I had a desire to kill babies just because it's fun. Now, would you say that I'm wrong? Would you say that I'm absolutely wrong for doing it for that?
Yes, you'd be wrong for killing babies. Killing babies is
according to what?
According to the nature of naturalist pantheism. It's the standard.
Yeah, but that's not your standard. I have a different. What if I had a different standard? That's your standard.
You can. You'd just be wrong.
I would be wrong. But once again, in your worldview, there is no objective standard. There is no objective standard in a transcendent standard.
No, there is an objective standard.
Yeah, but that's your opinion, Tom. That's your opinion.
So again, I'm saying I have an objective standard.
Yeah, you have an objective standard, but that's your opinion.
No. Your God is your opinion. God is your opinion.
Your opinion. Sure.
I have a different one.
Yeah, sure. But I guess my point is that from the atheistic worldview.
Objective morality. They do have an objective standard. Some atheists don't. Some atheists do. So just like you believe you have an objective standard, I also have an objective standard.
Yeah.
So I have a nature of naturalistic pantheism, objective standard. It's not applied to everyone. It is objective. Means if you believe killing, you're wrong. You're immoral. Standard of the pantheism.
But once again, you're making an objective standard on if you have an opinion of what your objective standard is, and I have an opinion of what my objective standard is, it's all relative at that point. Your standard is not anything that can call, you cannot call my standard wrong. You cannot say that my standard is wrong. Everything is relative. It's like, do you prefer peas or carrots, or do you prefer black or white socks? Everybody has a preference, and there is definitely no objective standard of wrong, of anything being wrong.
Well, gravity isn't an option. You can't, like, turn gravity off, right? You're physically forced to abide by gravity, correct?
Sure.
Morality is the exact same. It is a law of nature. You do not get an option. It is forced upon you whether you want to or not.
Yeah, but the law of nature...
pantheism...
Yeah, but there is a law of nature, but at the same time, there has to be an objective standard in order to make moral claims in that sense. And what I'm saying is that the objective standard has to come from a transcendent being that lays down, it has to come from an intelligent being. When we're talking about the morality of nature, we're talking about from the atheistic worldview or the evolutionary worldview, an undirected process. We're talking about somebody that there is no orchestra that's orchestrating this. No intelligent mind behind this.
Right. You don't need an intelligent mind. You just need an objective standard. And the objective standard does not need to be transcendent at all. It's just like gravity. We don't have an option of gravity. Gravity isn't transcendent. Gravity is physical and material. So we can have a physical material law of nature, which is moral law, just like we have a gravity law. So you don't need an object, you don't need a transcendent being, you don't need a non-physical anything. Now, do you the difference between epistemology and ontology?
Mm-hmm. Go
so
for
epistemology
it.
Is epistemology is how we know something, and ontology is the what exists. So something mm-hmm. that's independent of how we know it. So like if I am fizzing and I know that 1 + 1 = 2, like if I'm bleach and vinegar and I'm fizzing, and I know 1 + 1 = 2, 1 + 1 = 2 is true independent of how I know it. So the fact that I'm fizzing is irrelevant to whether or not 1 + 1 = 2 is true or not. So bringing up the fizzing stuff is irrelevant because how I get to know 1 + 1 = 2 doesn't make a difference. It's still true or false independently of how I get to know it. So the fact that I'm fizzing does not in any way make my beliefs less true.
But what I'm saying, that makes sense. But what I'm saying is that when we're talking about fizzing, it's random though. It's not anything that's controlled. There's not no intelligent mind behind it that's controlled.
It doesn't matter how you get to the knowledge. The knowledge is true regardless of how you get to it. So the fizzing, if we get from fizzing to knowledge, it's still true. You can still get knowledge that way. So the fizzing doesn't help your case. We can still get fizzing and get knowledge.
10-4. What would you consider yourself a radical skeptic?
No.
And why not?
Well, radical skepticism is essentially the skepticism of everything, like the skepticism that you exist, the skepticism that I'm looking at a screen right now, that we could be a brain in a vat or a matrix or whatever. No, I'm not a radical skeptic. I accept that things are fallibly true. We have fallible knowledge of things.
All right. Because would you say that Jesus Christ is a historical person?
Yes.
All right. Why would you reject? Do you accept that the New Testament and the Old Testament are historical documents?
Yes.
All right. So if you accept the historical documents and the Old New Testament historical documents, why would you say that the information that's inside of the New Testament, Old Testament are, as far as the supernatural God is concerned, is not true, or do you reject that?
Because the same way I reject all historical documents, because there's miracles in lots of them. There's miracles in all of the Roman historians prior to Jesus talking about the foundation of Rome with Remus and how they were raised by wolves. And there's all kinds of miracle claims all throughout history. But no amount of testimony, whether it's historical or contemporary or eyewitness, no amount of testimony justifies belief in anything that doesn't have an empirical basis. So, for example, if I told you I saw a dog, a living, breathing dog, that would be reasonable to believe. Okay. But if I told you I saw a living, breathing unicorn, that would not be reasonable to believe. The difference between these two claims, dogs have an implicit empirical basis, meaning there's lots of things that we can scientifically verify about dogs, like their taxonomy, phylogeny, chemical composition, what they eat, how to train them, what they're allergic to, the DNA, all of this kind of stuff that we can verify about dogs. That's implicit in the statement, I saw a dog. But none of that exists for unicorns. None of that empirical scientific stuff exists for unicorns. So it's reasonable to believe the statement, I saw a dog, because of the nation of my testimony alongside the empirical evidence of dogs. But reasonable to believe the statement, I saw a unicorn, because you only have the conceptual evidence of my testimony with no evidence to back it up. And so it's reasonable to believe testimony if it has an empirical basis to go along with it. That means that unreasonable to believe anything about miracles, magic, mythical creatures, the paranormal, natural, or UFOs based on testimony. Anything in any of the historical documents, whether it's the New Testament, the Old Testament, the Iliad, the Odyssey, any historical documents, none of that is reasonable to believe. It's about things that don't have an empirical basis, which means miracles, magic, mythical creatures, the paranormal, the supernatural, UFOs.
When it comes to historicity of the Bible, what is your position on? I guess you reject miracles altogether, right? You reject miracles altogether.
So I reject that evidence of miracles. That the Bible is evidence of the miracles.
Okay, so what about all the outside miracles? What about all the outside claims of miracles? Those individuals who claim to have had a miracle experience or a healing from miracles or things like that.
None of them be scientifically verified, so I don't accept them. Like, if you could make a little prediction and say, if we do this kind of prayer process and we can, like, record this person having a limb or something, then I would believe in miracles. If you could show me that, I accept miracles as soon as that happens. Yeah. But whenever they're tested by scientific testability and peer review, they always fail, 100% fail rate.
Do you, because I know for me, I had a friend actually who had pancreatic cancer. All right, he had pancreatic cancer, and he was diagnosed with it in the whole nine. And that, and we prayed over him, and everything, I know our body of believers prayed over him. And the next appointment that he went to, the pancreatic cancer was gone. That's just one test, that's one testimony of numerous testimonies. So, I guess my point is that is there anything that could convince you that the God of the Bible exists?
Well, have you heard of spontaneous remission?
Spontaneous remission. I could probably put the two words together and come to a conclusion definition of it, but go ahead, give me a rundown of it.
So 10% of people with cancer get miraculously healed or get just healed naturally, biological processes on their own all over the world, in every culture, in every society, regardless of religion, non-religion. 10% of people with cancer just heal naturally at all levels, of all degrees of severity. So the fact that someone got healed of cancer is the evidence of a miracle, because it happens all the time. It's not really that rare at all. You saw, if you prayed over someone and had a limb regrow, that's really good evidence. Like, that never happens in society. If you got someone's limb to regrow, that would be really impressive. I would be impressed by that. And this, so, but you asked the question about, what was it again? What evidence would convince me if
God exists? Is there any evidence that can convince you that the God of the Bible exists?
Partially yes, partially no. So the first thing is, you could convince me that there is a designer of the universe. You could convince me Yahweh, and that he had a son with Jesus and Jesus rose from the dead. Those can be supported by evidence. I can support those. You can't support the claim that he's all powerful. Like, if I told you I was all powerful and can hold infinitely many napkins, like, no amount of napkins I'm holding would ever convince you that I could hold infinitely many, because 80 billion trillion napkins is still 0% of infinite. So if God said he was infinitely powerful, and I watched him create 80 billion trillion universe, I still wouldn't be convinced he's infinitely powerful. Maybe there's something else that he can't do. Maybe there's something out there that he's not, that more powerful than he is. I couldn't be convinced of the omni properties, but I could be convinced of everything else. Like, you could definitely provide evidence of, give me a time back, watch Jesus be raised from the dead. Like, that's good evidence. I'm happy with that. You could show that God created the universe. That could be demonstrated too. So that would be possible to show. Show that it was Yahweh. Like, if I die and go to heaven and see Jesus and God there, and hey, how's it going? You were wrong. I'd be like, yep, that's good evidence. You guys exist. So I can believe all of the aspects of the Bible except the omni properties. Those would take a new kind just to haven't discovered.
All right. Take the omni properties, basically the properties of him being a deity, being the supernatural, all-powerful, all-knowing God.
Well, supernatural is fine. You can definitely show the supernatural. It's the part where it's like claiming that God was uncreated. Like, how could you possibly show God was uncreated? Because there could have always been a more powerful God that created God, and God just didn't know about it. I mean, what possible way could you demonstrate that? I mean, I don't know of any way to support that kind of a claim. It just seems to be something you have to believe on faith. Well, so I wouldn't be able to believe those kinds of claims, but I would definitely be able to believe in the supernatural. You could demonstrate the supernatural right now.
Yeah, but I think this is why I asked you where you're a radical skeptic. This is the reason why I asked you where you're a radical skeptic, because it came off to me, it seems to me anyway, from your past interviews, it seems to me that there's practically, it would take some super duper miraculous ordeal for you to be able to come to the conclusion that the God of the Bible exists. There is really no fundamental evidence that can show you that God exists or prove to you that God exists. And from that, you know, from that idea, I believe that all people believe in God. I believe that all people do have a belief in God. I believe that a sensus divinitus applies to all human beings. I believe that we are aware of the fact that we are created, that we are a created being, that we are created from a transcendent mind, namely God, of the God of the Bible. It's practically impossible for anyone to make claims such as morals, to make logical claims and things like that without the God of the Bible. It's by his standard, his nature, that we have these laws in place, the moral law and the logical law, laws of logic, sorry. And I just think that when we put a standard so high, and where that we are not willing to allow for God to be able to show through evidence, that I think we have a big problem there.
Well, let me pick up on that.
Okay,
so if I claimed I could create infinitely many universes, like, how many universes would it take before you were convinced that I could create infinitely many?
If you can, a claim, just a claim?
Right.
Just a claim.
So I'm saying,
I wouldn't be very convinced if you just claimed it.
Right. So what evidence would convince you that create infinitely many universes?
I would definitely have to have evidence within your nature, within you, to be able to show me that you are able to do so.
Okay, let's say I create 10 universes. Are you convinced that I can create infinitely many?
Not really.
Okay, how about 100?
Possibly. Possibly. Possibly.
Okay, how about 80 billion trillion?
Yeah, I'm probably convinced at that point, man. No.
Okay, I am currently holding 80 billion trillion gluons in my hand. Are you convinced that I can hold infinitely many?
Possibly, yes, I guess.
So gluons are the things that make up protons and neutrons.
Okay, sure. I'm not on that par. So go ahead, school me a little bit on
that. So I'm currently holding like 80 billion trillion of them in my hand right now with this bottle of water.
Okay.
But you probably wouldn't be convinced that I could hold infinitely many protons and neutrons, right? Because sure. I can't pick up a car.
Sure.
So the fact that I can hold some finite number, even 80 billion trillion, shouldn't convince you that I can hold infinitely many. Infinite is a big number. Boom. No finite number, or any finite number you give, is 0% of infinite. Mm-hmm. So the fact that I can hold 80 billion trillion or create 80 billion trillion universe doesn't convince you that I can hold, control, or create infinitely many. There's a big difference between there. And so the reason I can't believe God is all powerful is because of that. It's like there's no way for me to assess infinitely much evidence. I can only assess a limited amount. But I'd still be reasonable to believe that in the supernatural. Like you could demonstrate the supernatural right now. If I said... I pray to a supernatural being to generate a gold brick in front of me, and poof, a gold brick comes in front of me, I would believe in the supernatural. I'd be like, yep, that's good evidence of the supernatural. And if you gave me a time machine and I saw Jesus raised from the dead, I would believe in Jesus. I would believe that Jesus has supernatural powers. If you showed God creating the universe, I would believe God created the universe. I'm happy to believe all of that stuff. I can believe in pretty much everything. Like 99% of Christianity could be demonstrated with evidence. It's only that one thing. And that wouldn't make me reject Christianity as a whole. Like if you could show the other 99%, that's pretty good evidence. But I just wouldn't be able to believe that last bit about those omni properties. So there is evidence you could present that could demonstrate Christianity is true for the most part. There's just that one part that's really hard to demonstrate.
Yeah. When it comes to the idea of coming to faith in Jesus Christ as the Lord and Savior, that is a testimony. That is a supernatural effect that happens to the heart. It's a regeneration of the heart. So from that regard, yeah, I can't give you as an testimony to you and say that's evidence of that God exists. And I would not present that as evidence as God exists. The only thing I could pray and hope for is that God would change your heart and call you to repentance and call you out of your sin and to his glorious salvation. So I'm sort of at the butt end of this interview. I wanted to just, once again, just emphasize, obviously I do disagree with you on the idea that, on the understanding that, that you can have your reality from the atheistic worldview, that your reality is consistent and you can actually know things, you can have knowledge and everything without the transcendent God being a presupposition or a foundational aspect to that. I when it comes to random chemical reactions going on in the brain, there's obviously issues with that. I feel that when it comes to that, I don't think that could put out the information, the correct information in the sense that that is needed in order to come to logical, knowledge-based reality decisions. And obviously we disagree on that. We disagree on that big time. And that's fine. But I do pray that God will speak to your heart and God will call you out of that life, and that you will put your faith and your hope in Jesus Christ, the Lord Messiah, and go with it with that, man. I'll be praying for you. And once again, I want to thank you for joining me on my show. I look forward to hearing your future conversations with other Christians as well. I think those conversations are good to have.
Thanks. Yeah, I really appreciate it. Do you have a little more time? Because I wanted to ask you about what you said earlier, that you believe everyone has knowledge of a God. Yeah, so you said everyone has knowledge of a God. As far as I know, I don't have knowledge of a God. So where is it? Like, how do I have knowledge of a God if I am not aware that I have knowledge of a God?
Well, John Calvin and his institute spoke of a sense of divinitas. And what that implies is that there's a sense of the divine. And there's a belief that there's a belief within a Christian fold. And John Calvin gets that from the biblical text that says that all sinners suppress the truth in unrighteousness. So the whole idea is that all human beings have a sense of that they were created by a divine being, namely the God of the Bible. And in that, they suppress the truth of that knowledge and they suppress the truth that there is a God in unrighteousness, in their sin. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but how do I suppress it exactly? Like, it's the sensus divinitatis is definitely, I'm pretty familiar with me behind it, but
okay.
If I'm suppressing the idea, does that mean it's in my subconscious and I'm not aware of it? Like, how, or am I aware of it? I'm just lying. Like, where, how does that work? I don't understand.
Well,
because
it's a spiritual condition, in that your spirit is dead in sin. So if your spirit is dead in sin, you're going to do whatever you can in order to reject the God of the Bible, and you're going to grab hold of to your sin. So when your soul is dead in your sin, you're suppressing that truth of the living God, because it says in the Bible that God has made his truth known in all creation. He's made his existence known to everyone. Everyone is without an excuse when it comes to God. Also, it takes a special revelation in the sense to know that Jesus Christ is Messiah. He has to do a regenerative work in your heart. But there is not a supernatural revelation that needs to take place in the fundamental idea and aspects that the God of the Bible does exist. So that's pretty much the premise behind that.
Well, follow a little bit, because if I'm suppressing it, which means I'm not aware of it, then how can I have knowledge of it if I'm not aware of it? Because doesn't that mean it's not knowledge? If I'm
no, it's a when it comes to suppressing, it's a spiritual condition. So you may be in yourself, in your brain, you may be saying, like, you know, I don't know if there's a God of the Bible. But in your soul, in your spirit, there's definitely that aspect, because your soul is dead. There's definitely an aspect that God of the Bible does exist. So in turn, you're suppressing it. It might not be something that's at the forefront of your mind, but it might not be something that's at the forefront of your mind. You're thinking about 24 hours a day, but it's a separation between what the heart is saying and what the soul is saying and what your mind is saying. So if your heart and your soul is saying one thing, your heart and your soul is saying one thing, and your heart and soul is saying, I am in bondage to my sin and I reject the God of the Bible, your mind is going to be focused on those things that are contrary to righteousness, that are contrary to those things that are glorifying to God. So in other words, there is no neutral stance from the atheistic worldview, or the person who rejects God, the God of the Bible, there is no neutral stance when it comes to God. Either you believe or you don't. And the reason that someone does not believe is not that they inherently do not believe like that there is no God, but it's because they're suppressing it. They're suppressing that truth in unrighteousness.
So if I don't have access to it with my brain, then doesn't that mean it's not, doesn't that mean I don't know it? Because if for it to be knowledge, don't I have to necessarily have access to it to my brain? You said it's in your heart and your soul, mm-hmm. But wouldn't that be something different than knowledge? That would be like a supernatural kind of a knowledge? Because the knowledge I'm thinking of, for it to be knowledge, you have to know it in your brain, right?
Well, I guess when it comes to having knowledge of God and the revelation of God, It is believed that all human beings have that knowledge, that fundamental basis, not basic knowledge of that we are created from a transcendent being, that we are created with a purpose. But because we live our lives in such a fashion that we have such a purpose. So, but when it comes to suppressing that truth, it's not necessarily a knowledge claim, like a knowledge in the sense that you read a book and now you come to the knowledge of something. It's a supernatural lie. It's a revelation of knowledge when it comes to the fact that, yes, I am, that Jesus Christ is Lord and Savior. That's what you call a special revelation. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, that definitely helps me out a lot, because this was always a point of contention between me and a lot of theists, where I tried to understand what they meant by suppressing. But yeah, it makes sense the way you portrayed it, as saying that there's like a kind of knowledge in our head and a kind of knowledge in our hearts and souls. I understand that a lot clearer, so thanks for that.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I really appreciated the opportunity, and I do really enjoy these conversations, so thanks.
All right, cool. Thanks, Tom. I appreciate you. And once again, thank you for joining me. Perhaps we can have this conversation again. I'm trying to set up debates. I'm trying to set up different individuals come on and talk to each other, converse with each other on various subjects. So thank you once again for coming on. I appreciate you.
Absolutely. Talk to you later.
All right. Thanks, Tom. All right. That's it, folks. Conversation with Tom Jump. And obviously we have different aspects. We have different understanding, different ideas. And once again, I want to thank Tom Jump for coming on. With that said,
I want to encourage you to go ahead and like and follow my Facebook page, The Gospel Truth, and also follow, subscribe to my YouTube page, The Gospel Truth. Also, coming July, I'll be announcing the new book giveaway, and see if you guys want to participate in that to win a free book. I have not announced what book it is, but I will shortly. June 26th, I'll be having Joshua Arnold on, and he'll be coming on. We'll be discussing his break free from drug addiction and his transition from the New Age movement. Also, I'll be having Adam Coleman coming on with me July 6th, and we'll be talking about urban apologetics. And July 15th, I'll be having David Shannon coming on from Cross Politics, and we'll be talking about the whole abortion issue within the political realm and our subcultures. So I hope you guys can join me for that. Once again, thank you for joining me on this episode. Let's pray. Let's keep time jumping prayer that God does a supernatural work in his heart, that he does come to that special revelation that Jesus Christ is the Lord and Messiah. And thank you once again for joining me. May God bless you. May God keep you. Until next time. Thank you.